Our history is often told through the victories of the strong or the suffering of the weak, but there is a middle ground, a gray space, where the line between the law and the lawless vanishes. This is the story of the Blue Wall and the Silent Street. It is the story of how our protectors became our captors. Across our islands, from the hills of Kingston to the docks of Port of Spain, a shadow was allowed to grow.
Cool.
It did not happen overnight. It was built brick by brick. A bribe here, a look the other way there. Eventually, the silence became a survival strategy. When the person with the badge is the one holding the bag, who do you call? We are looking at the rot inside the system. We are looking at the price of our own complicity. Chapter 1. The Birth of the Enforcer. The transition from colonial rule to independence was supposed to be a handoff of power to the people. Instead, in many of our nations, the police force remained a tool of the state rather than a servant of the public. In the 1970s, as political tensions reached a boiling point, the role of the officer shifted. They were no longer just keepers of the peace, they became the heavy hand of political parties. In the garrisons and the housing schemes, the officer and the local don often shared the same breakfast table. We saw the birth of the political enforcer. The state provided the uniforms and the guns. The politicians provided the targets. In exchange, the officers were given a license to operate outside the law. It began with small favors. A dossier gone missing. A witness who suddenly forgot a face. This was the era where the police became a paramilitary arm of the ruling class. The goal was not to stop crime. The goal was to manage it. In Jamaica, the Special Operations Squad and later the Crime Management Unit became symbols of this era. They were feared, they were efficient, but they were also untouchable. When the law operates in the dark, it quickly forgets which side it is on. The community saw this. They felt the pressure of the boot. They learned quickly that complaining to the sergeant meant painting a target on your own back. The culture of the payoff became a standard operating procedure. A routine traffic stop was no longer about road safety. It was a tax collection. This small-scale corruption acted as the gateway. It softened the moral fabric of the force. If you can take a few dollars to ignore a broken taillight, you can take a few thousand to ignore a boat at the pier. By the end of the decade, the infrastructure of corruption was set. The police were no longer an independent body. They were a fractured organization. Some were honest men and women trying to do a job. Others were ghosts in the machine. They worked for the highest bidder. They worked for the party. They worked for themselves. The public trust did not just break, it was dismantled. As the 1980s approached, a new player entered the Caribbean. High-grade narcotics began to flow through our waters. The political enforcer was about to find a much wealthier master. The guns were already on the street, and the men meant to take them away were the ones who had delivered them. Chapter 2. The Blue Wall of Silence. The Blue Wall is not just a metaphor. It is a physical barrier made of retracted statements and missing evidence lockers. By the 1990s, the corruption had moved from the street level to the administrative core. Internal affairs departments became places where complaints went to die. If an officer tried to speak out against a corrupt colleague, they were not rewarded. They were isolated. They were transferred to the furthest outposts. Sometimes, they simply disappeared from the payroll. This internal rot created a vacuum. In this vacuum, the informer-fi dead culture took root. It is easy for outsiders to judge our communities for not speaking to the police. It is harder to speak when you know the officer taking your statement is the cousin of the man you are reporting. We saw high-profile cases go cold not for lack of evidence, but because the evidence was an embarrassment to the force. In Trinidad and Tobago, the rise of kidnapping for ransom highlighted this crisis. Families were often told not to involve the police. The kidnappers knew the police response times. They knew the radio frequencies. In some cases, the getaway cars were identified as unmarked police vehicles. This realization was a psychological blow to our collective identity. When the wolf is the shepherd, the flock is never safe. The silence grew louder. It was a heavy, suffocating thing. It lived in the bars where officers drank with known traffickers. It lived in the courtrooms where files were lost by the prosecution. The legal system became a revolving door for those with the right connections. This created a profound sense of hopelessness. Witness intimidation became a refined art. You did not need to kill every witness. You only had to kill one, and make sure everyone saw it. The police would arrive late. They would fail to secure the scene. They would treat the victim's family like the criminals. This was complicity in its purest form. It was the deliberate failure to act. Our history shows that once a police force loses its moral compass, it is almost impossible to recalibrate. The good officers, and there were many, found themselves trapped. They had to choose between their lives and their oaths. Most chose silence. That silence was the mortar that held the blue wall together. But the wall was about to be tested by a force more powerful than local politics. The shadow economy was growing, and it was no longer satisfied with just buying officers. It wanted to own the entire map. The line between the police station and the drug warehouse was about to vanish entirely. Chapter 3. The Shadow Economy. In the modern era, the cost of corruption is measured in more than just blood. It is a drag on our entire economy. When the police are for sale, the entire nation is on the auction block. The 1990s and the early 2000s saw the Caribbean become a primary transit point for transnational crime. The sheer volume of money involved was enough to drown the annual budget of a small island. The shadow economy does not just trade in drugs and guns. It trades in influence. We saw senior officers in various islands being named in international indictments. We saw police aircraft used to move cargo that never appeared on a manifest. The corruption had become a corporate enterprise. The community impact was devastating. As the police focused on protecting the flow of illegal goods, they abandoned the protection of the people. Private security became a multi-billion dollar industry. If you were rich, you could buy safety. If you were poor, you were at the mercy of the shadow. This created a two-tiered society, one that lived behind high walls and one that lived in the crossfire. We must look at the cost of this silence. It is the cost of every unsolved murder. It is the cost of every business that closed because it could not pay the protection tax. It is the cost of a generation of children who grow up seeing the police as an occupying force rather than a community resource. There have been attempts at reform. Foreign investigators have been brought in. Commission after commission has sat and produced thick reports. Some officers have been purged. Some units have been disbanded and rebranded. But the roots go deep. You cannot fix a rotten foundation with a coat of paint. The legacy of this era is a profound cynicism. We hear the sirens and we do not think of help. We think of trouble. We see the flashing lights and we check our pockets. This is the way we carry. Our history is scarred by the moments when those we trusted to hold the line were the ones who broke it. The silence remains. It is a habit now. A reflex. We look at the state of our streets and we know the truth. The law is only as strong as the men and women who enforce it. And for too long, the law was just another product for sale. The price of that sale is a debt that our children are still paying in a currency of fear.